Thank you. May it please the court.
It does.
We are here today on an attorney disciplinary proceeding that was tried to a disciplinary hearing panel in which the panel found and recommended that the respondent, Ronald K. Barker, be disbarred.
Are you prepared? You just got a copy. Did you just get a copy of the respondent's brief today also?
I received it about 5 o'clock yesterday afternoon. I am prepared to proceed.
Okay, thank you.
The Chief Disciplinary Counsel concurs in the recommendation for disbarment because the evidence suggests a very clear case of misappropriation of client proceeds. What occurred in late 2006, early 2007, was Mr. Barker, the respondent, settled a personal injury claim and a contract claim on behalf of his client, Hank Medlin. That settlement resulted in $287,000 being paid by two separate insurance companies. That money was placed in the trust account, which is a good thing. The first problem with that settlement process is there was no settlement distribution sheet provided to the client. Mr. Barker suggests that he offered to provide one to the client and the client declined. The problem with that is regardless of whether the client wants a settlement distribution statement, the lawyer has an obligation to maintain accurate trust account records for his own records for purposes such as our disciplinary case.
So, but he supposedly took $91,000, which would probably approximate one-third of the $286,000. Couldn't he kind of say, well, that was my fee?
Well, he took an additional $64,000 as his fee.
Oh, beyond the $91,000 or in the $91,000?
I think the breakdown essentially was out of the $287,000, the one-third fee was about $90-some thousand dollars that was split $64,000 with Mr. Barker and another $30-some thousand to co-counsel in the case. So Mr. Barker received his $64,000 in attorney's fees within the first week or two after the settlement proceeds cleared to the bank, actually probably within a month. And then after...
Aren't these checks two-party checks? I mean, doesn't the plaintiff have to sign the checks too?
The insurance company checks, I don't know if they were two-party checks. They probably likely were, but they were deposited into the trust account, which I think is probably customary for settlement proceeds to be placed in the trust account. And then from there,
why it's a trust account, because it's a two-party check. The money belongs to the two parties, not to one party.
I don't believe that the claim belongs to the client.
Right.
An attorney may have a lien on those proceeds, but that the proceeds belong to the client. The client's the owner of the proceeds. And if you're doing your trust accounting correctly, you'll be able to look at your trust account records and always understand which funds are owned by which client. This was a situation where
does the bank have any responsibility to? It's a two-party check. I mean, to deposit the check, you'd have to show both parties are depositing a check in their account. If it's in a trust account, the bank has a responsibility to protect the owners of the money from being having the money given away to the wrong people.
I believe there's provisions either under the UCC or under the Uniform Trust Code where the bank has some protections to accept checks from a fiduciary. And in this case, and in many settlements, a lawyer will write himself or herself a check from his trust account to an operating account that represents that portion of the attorney's fees. That occurred in this case with several checks, but once the initial $64,000 in attorney's fees and the co-counsel's fees were dispersed, then there remained a balance after everything else was dispersed of the $93,000. And that's the money.
So after they took their fee, there was an extra $93,000 that was taken out?
Yes. After the fees were paid and the expenses were paid, some money was dispersed directly to the client. and some money was dispersed to pay the client's creditors.
And the 93 is the money that Mr. Barker says his client said, please don't distribute it to me because I don't have an account and I haven't paid my taxes and I don't want to have it in my possession. And he says that money was used to pay expenses of the client, and also that he borrowed some of it with permission. And the DHP, and it's your position, is that it was misappropriated without permission?
That's correct, yes. That $93,000 was removed from the trust account over 27 separate checks to get that money out of the trust account that occurred over a one-year period of time.
Were any of those separate checks used for clearly for the attorney's benefit, not the client's?
They were all used for the attorney's benefit because they were deposited directly into the attorney's operating account, from which the attorney paid office overhead and even some personal mortgage and insurance expenses.
Does whether this case is a case of gross misunderstanding of the rules regarding trust accounts versus misappropriation depend on if you believe the reasons for why it was taken out and whether or not the promissory notes were written contemporaneously and whether they were showed to the client? Is it a credibility issue really on how serious the misconduct was?
Well, I think there's circumstantial evidence that's abundant that if you look at the way the transaction actually occurred, this was a deliberate attempt to steal money from a client. The checks, as they were written from the trust account into the respondent's bank account, each one of them said attorney's fees. The respondent testified that he knew that was false. He knew that none of those checks were attorney's fees. Had they been loan proceeds, they would have said.
Was any referral made to the police or to the district attorney?
Not yet, Your Honor. But that is something that is under consideration. We did have a member of the disciplinary panel that looked at this was the prosecuting attorney from Jackson County, and we have considered a referral to his office, as well as allowed the attorney for the probate estate to also conduct their own.
Now, the OCDC is extremely cooperative in working with people that have problems. I've seen this on many occasions, and I applaud their efforts to try to help attorneys who have trouble managing their accounts or managing their finances or organizational issues. They have courses and classes and this kind of thing, and courses and classes on the trust accounts. It's a wonderful program that the OCDC. Was there any attempt whatsoever to work this thing out and try to cooperate and maybe get this money reimbursed or something?
Your Honor, no. And the reason for that is when you have a deliberately dishonest attempt of misappropriation of client money, you can't correct that behavior by ethics school. You can't correct that behavior by educating the lawyer about the ins and outs of Rule 1.15. This goes directly to a lawyer's honesty and fitness to practice law that no amount of education or counseling or working with the attorney would cure or would have any remedial effect.
At what point in the inquiry did the concept of a loan first was it raised by Mr. Barker?
Well, the client died in September of 2008.
And his was it his brother?
His brother was appointed the personal rep. The personal rep made requests of the Mr. Barker in November of 2008. There was no mention of there being correct. The request for accountings. There was no mention of there being promissory notes at that time. The promissory notes actually came about after a bar complaint was made. A bar complaint was made in February of 2009. Mr. Barker's response was submitted to the OCDC on March 2nd, 2009.
Well, what right does he have to the client's money? I don't understand this at all. I mean, client has a right to the money. You give him a check. That's it.
The reason it's a misappropriation is because it is the client's money, and he had no right to it.
His defense is that, and I'm sure we'll hear from him, is that the client asked him to keep the money, and the client gave permission for him to borrow it and was aware of the promissory notes. But is there Is there anything in the record that reflects that they existed prior to the bar complaint?
Yeah, there's no evidence that there was any mention or any thought of a promissory note prior to February of 2009 when the bar complaint was made, and there's no evidence in the entire record that the client ever consented to having his money borrowed.
What did he first say when the personal representative asked for the accounting? Did he just not respond until February?
Or? He sent a letter that didn't directly provide an accounting, mentioned a few other things about a box of documents, and there was a payment of $38,000 that was made from the trust account to the decedent's estate. That letter, again, doesn't mention anything about there being any borrowings. In fact, the letter says the rest of the money is coming as soon as I get a tax ID number. The evidence in this case was in November of 2008, respondent had absolutely no money to make good on any of the payments, whether they were borrowed or misappropriated. He didn't have any money and was just stalling to gain more time.
And the $38,000 was borrowed from a friend and then deposited in the trust account and paid out?
That's correct, because the attorney for the estate said, I hope the money's still in your trust account, and lo and behold, the week later, a trust account check for $38,000 shows up. But the clear record is that money came from a friend, was placed in the trust account to make it look like the funds had been in the trust account all along, and then was distributed or was submitted to the probate estate, not as loan repayment, but as a settlement distribution.
Was all this, I guess the client could say, I don't want my money, and that would be a waiver of their right to the money. Was that presented to the hearing panel?
Well, of course, in September of 2008, the client died, so there was absolutely no opportunity for any testimony from the client.
But then the personal rep, he didn't say he didn't want his money. He wanted the money, the personal
correct.
Rep.
Correct. There was no one, including his family and the decedent's girlfriend, had ever any inkling that Hank Medlin had consented to loaning money to his own attorney. That was a complete shock to the family and to those close around him. So there was these promissory notes surfaced for the first time.
Were there any signed promissory notes? Were they signed?
They were signed by the respondent, of course, as a typical promissory note.
Right.
They're not signed by the lender, and there's no other document in the record signed by the lender, no email or letter or any sort of written document showing that Mr. Medlin had consented to having his money being loaned to the respondent.
And there's no checks written, and there's no memo on any checks written that say loan. They say basically they indicate that it's a reimbursement of a settlement fee.
Correct. There's two sets of checks. There's checks that were written from the trust account to Mr. Barker's operating account. All of those checks say attorney's fees.
Those say fees.
And then there was another set of checks where Mr. Barker actually attempted to replenish the funds that he had taken from the trust account. And all of those checks continue to say settlement distribution, when if you look at the trust account record, you can see that within roughly 9 months after the settlement, all $287,000 had been fully depleted, and the respondent was essentially robbing Peter to pay Paul to pay back the money. And it had the money that he was writing on the checks, although they said settlement distributions, had nothing to do with the actual settlement proceeds.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, do you have any mitigating circumstances as to why this would occur? Is there medical problems, any kind of issues there?
There were medical problems, but I didn't realize them until I took the first Keeping Your Law Practice on Track and talked with a psychologist who...
What are you saying, on crack?
Pardon me?
On track.
Keeping Your Law Practice on Track. You mentioned that there were programs offered by the Chief Disciplinary or the Missouri Bar on this, and for the last 3 years I've attended the one-day seminar on keeping your law practice on track.
Okay.
And at the first one, the psychologist mentioned a problem that I had, and that was excessive sighing. And he said that was an indication of depression or anxiety.
Excessive sighing?
Sighing. Just...
Oh, okay.
You haven't offered medical evidence from a physician?
No, I haven't. I didn't have much of...
that depression was the reason for your conduct?
I don't know.
Have you been medicated for depression? Have you
yes.
gotten Alvil or anything like that?
It's citalopram, which is Celexa, I think.
So you've been under medical care about depression for how long?
Since 2009.
So how did all this happen prior to that time?
Okay, three things. Three main things. Miscalculation of my fees, the lack of tax identification numbers, and now I've... And two of them were only brought out. The third one is Medicaid lien. But when I received the settlement proceeds and did the calculation, and you'll see on Exhibit 11 that I did a calculation, and I only calculated $287,000. In effect, I left out $41,715 of recovery that we did for Mr. Medlin, and I shorted myself.
But you didn't send Mr. Medlin a letter saying, oh, really, I'm entitled to another $13,000?
No, I didn't do that, because I didn't realize it until the hearing.
So that wasn't why you took the money, is my point.
Exactly. When Lynn Ballou brought it up at the disciplinary panel hearing, he said, so you enhanced his recovery by $41,000, and I went, oh, yeah, I guess I did. But neither I nor Mr. Lefevre caught that. And the other thing at the hearing that got my attention was the fact that Hank Medlin was on assistance. I didn't know that. I thought he was trying to avoid taxes.
And avoid taxes. I mean, I've been in practice, but when I'd get a check from an insurance company, they would say this is in settlement of the claim. I would go to I'd get the check co-signed by the claimant, and I'd. After 10 days or after the check cleared, I just give them their money and keep my money. There's no problem.
That's what I wanted to do. He didn't have any place to put it.
What?
He didn't have any place to put it.
It's an easy way to open a checking account.
I made it my problem because he was a very heavy man, 400 to 500 pounds, had health problems, and wanted me to help him pay his bills, make sure his mother
got paid.
But you
could open up a bank account for him. I mean, it's not like you have to, or a structured settlement.
I don't want to open up a bank account in my name for him.
Mr. Barker, are you denying that you did anything inappropriate?
I don't deny that I commingled counsel's or commingled funds.
So you don't admit that you misused client funds?
No, I don't admit that because he wanted to maximize his recovery. He didn't want to put it. He wanted.
Well, assuming you had a legitimate reason for keeping it, that's an entirely different question than misappropriating it. I mean, you shouldn't have had it in the first place. You should have distributed it. But assuming it's there, I mean, there's a real credibility question here.
I understand.
You claim there were promissory notes, but there's no evidence of it. He didn't know about it. He had no records of it. They said settlement proceeds, or they said other kinds of things. Nothing ever said attorney's fees. Nothing said promissory notes. There's it's your word versus everything else on the record, isn't it?
Well, I think the whole record's wrong now based on the miscalculation of my fees.
But that's only $13,000, not
right,
the additional $80,000.
Right. And then I borrowed money to put back in there at $38,000 from a friend of mine.
Yeah, that's not what you said to the trustee. You didn't say, he lent me some money, here's part of it back, I'll
no.
pay it back per...
He said he didn't care where it came from.
What did you understand from your training with the OCDC, the Missouri Bar? What did you understand when you had a client trust account? What was your understanding of the word trust or what a client
trust
account was for?
Well, my understanding was if I had an agreement with a client after everything was paid off, he pulled out the major parts of the money that he wanted, and I had an understanding that after all that was done, that I could make an agreement with him to borrow money if I borrowed it at a reasonable amount of interest, which was 9%. I borrowed money before at 9% and paid it back. And
from your client?
From one client. From another client.
And what do the rules require, the rules of professional conduct require if you are dealing
They require written agreement, and I didn't have that.
With your client signing?
Right, right. If
there was an agreement for a loan, why wouldn't the checks indicate loan as opposed to attorney's fees?
Did you ever seek
help from management, help from the OCDC, from the Missouri Bar?
At that time?
Anytime.
Yes. I mean, I've received these invitations to go to this Keeping Your Practice on Track, and I've done what they've asked me to do.
Sir, I don't mean to interrupt, but I didn't hear your response. I know Judge Teitelman asked you another question. What was the response as to why the memo on the check indicated that they were fees instead of a loan?
That was just what I wrote on the check at the time. I always pretty much distinguish between settlement distribution and attorney's fees. I didn't put down there that it was a loan. I know I probably should have done that.
So you took loans without a written agreement, without any written record that they were loans?
Except,
and the only record shows they were attorney's
except
fees.
For the promissory notes. And in fact, I did the promissory note both for me and for my professional corporation. I signed for both of them, and then I only got sued. I didn't understand that.
And they all were dated 2009, you said, because of a computer? Were they dated all the way along? What's the record about the
Well, the record notes? Is I replaced computers in 2009. And when you replace your computer, the new computer picks up the date of installation as the creation date.
So there were actually no dates in the notes themselves. They didn't say when they were done.
Oh, no. The notes have dates on them. The notes have dates back to, it starts April of 2000.
Did they happen to find any of these signed notes in the decedent's property?
He wouldn't take them. It's in the record. I went to the decedent's house on several occasions to take documents to him that he needed, probably checks, and he wouldn't let me in the house. He raised the garage door, and it was very obvious he was a hoarder, I guess, a clutter bug or whatever. The garage was filled with boxes. The room that was downstairs next to the garage was filled with boxes and stacked with papers, newspapers, and other kinds of papers. And then his girlfriend testified at the hearing that he didn't keep records.
But you had no printed out signed promissory notes. Everything was just unsigned in your computer.
He said, you keep track of it, and I figured that the best way to keep track of it was to do a little promissory note for every amount that I took when I took it. And usually, if I didn't record it, I had it in my checkbook. If I didn't record it that day as a promissory note, I would prepare the promissory note on the weekend when I work on Saturdays. Anyway.
But you knew he was vulnerable. In some way, you knew he was troubled. He was vulnerable. And yet you were having these sort of, and
Hank
you're relying Medlin, on this like oral communications to set up loans.
Hank Medlin was not a vulnerable man. He was very loud and aggressive type. He had been a previous Army officer in Vietnam.
But he said he wouldn't let you in the. He wouldn't let you in the house. He wouldn't.
He would raise the garage door and come out. You know, it was obvious he didn't want me to come in. He would come out on the driveway.
Your client's estate, the decedent's estate, has sued you for repayment of funds,
and
the trial court has found there was really no evidence of any borrowing going on, that you owed the money,
right.
But you still failed to date to repay the funds.
Yeah, because now I know of more. And one of the reasons...
Now you're what? I didn't hear.
Now I know of more that I still have to do in representing him in this. One of them is that I miscalculated my fees. The second one is I need tax identification numbers because the IRS wants $40,000 from me on these payments. And the third is there's a Medicaid lien that nobody researched, and the cost recovery unit of the Department of Health Services is putting together that, but they have difficulty because I can't furnish them a tax ID number.
But you don't have the money in the account.
I don't have the money in the account. I'm trying to collect on a decision, you've heard about that, I'm sure now, on a decision that I should have had 5 years ago in the Doolin versus Kent DeSell matter, and I can't seem to get the Circuit Court of Jackson County, Missouri, to enter a judgment on a summary judgment that's over 2 years old now.
Our charge is to protect the public from lawyers who have a trust to the public and to their clients, not to that they would not act unethically or to the disadvantage of their clients. And, and part of that is to have an organized, run their offices and business. How can we trust that you could still practice law, given what you've said here today about the inability to calculate your fees, calculate Medicaid, do all these other things and that don't seem to reflect on your ability to practice law in a, I'm not saying just in court, but just mind your own papers and court documents.
Take a look at the trust account records that are in the record here, and you'll see that there was another client whose money I was receiving on a periodic basis for a settlement in a commercial advertising case. And that when I received the money in, they got their two-thirds right out of the account, and I received my one-third. And those are in the same records that these transactions are in. That was the only two cases I had where I was depositing
settlement.
Do you
have an accountant that manages your office? Who manages your finances?
I do. Not very well, I suspect.
So how can we set you loose on the public?
I don't think that I've been turned loose on the public. It's about the client. Hank Medlin wanted to maximize what he got out of this because he knew that he wanted some money for retirement and he wanted some money for his daughter. I borrowed the $38,000 to pay into his account so they'd have funeral expenses and so his daughter would have some money. I didn't challenge the action in the probate court because I don't think it's right for lawyers to increase the legal fees in a case that can be resolved. And if I had opposed that in probate court, I can see where those fees went. I had a case where lawyers in Kansas charged $300,000 against an estate that had $400,000 in it because they knew it was there. I refuse to allow lawyers to run up fees in cases where it's not necessary. The deposition, I don't know if the deposition was necessary or not by Mr. Allender, but he made no inquiry whatsoever as to a Medicaid lien when I presumed that he had that information. I didn't have it until Brenda Ford testified to it in the panel hearing here. So it's about the client. It's about taking care both of the client and of the state of Missouri on their lien. And even when I get their lien, it's still my responsibility to go through it and make sure everything they're charging for relates to the accident back in July of 2003. That's what lawyers do. And they say that, well, you continue to represent him after you did this. Well, that's part of the fee, isn't it? I think it is. So I don't think you're turning me loose on the public. If I'd have had more time at the panel hearing, which went from 9 o'clock in the morning until 7 at night, and I got to put on evidence at 6, and they wanted to conclude it. It's all in the record. They wanted to conclude it that night. Well, where's my chance to call witnesses at 7 o'clock at night or 6 o'clock at night?
Did you have your witnesses there?
I had my daughter there. Witnesses on call, but, you know, at 7 o'clock in the evening, you're not going to get them anymore.
Did you ask them for a continuance? Or
no, I didn't. I said, okay, here's the documents that I have, and I put them into evidence.
So you made no objection that you didn't have enough time to put your case in?
No, no. And you'll also notice in the procedure of the panel hearing that Mr. Ballou was sick. He had pneumonia that day, I believe. But he couldn't hear. And then I figured out that the apparatus that they had in the hearing room, unless it was pointed directly at the person talking, Mr. Ballou couldn't hear. And so we lost contact with him several times. I don't think that was a fair process. And the other part of the process I don't think was fair that should be addressed by the court is that...
Did you make objection that the process wasn't fair when they came out with their decision?
No, I didn't. I have it written up, but I didn't do it.
Did you ever inform the OCDC that...
No, I haven't done that. And the other part of the process is these two of the three members of the panel had frequently worked together and teamed up, as the language they used off the record. I think if you're going to have a hearing of that import, that you ought to at least allow some information as to the number of people who have teamed up on panels before. You're only allowed two strikes, and if I were doing their jury selection, asking them voir dire questions, I would ask them, "Have do you know this other person on the panel?" Because there's a lot of people on the panel list, and have you ever been on a panel with this person? How many times? I think that's important. But
did you ever object to that procedure?
No, I didn't. And I did approve of the telephone procedure at the very beginning, until at the end I just figured out what was wrong. And my comment in the record is that, oh, I know what's wrong. You have to point that at each witness. So I would still like to have my judgment in Jackson County.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your position.
Just a few quick points in rebuttal, Your Honors. The issue with the miscalculation of fees is really kind of a red herring. I think the bottom line on that is that if there's a $13,000 discrepancy in the way respondent calculated his fees, he stole $80,000 instead of $93,000. The attorney fee contract that he had provided for a one-third fee of all amounts recovered on behalf of the client. It wasn't worded so that it would entitle Mr. Barker to a contingency fee on some sort of incidental other benefit that the client received. But the more important reason is that we have a final judgment from the probate court in this case that fixes the amount that Mr. Barker owed, which is $43,000. That judgment is entitled to res judicata and collateral estoppel in this case. And
was there any attempt at collection on this judgment?
I don't believe so, because I believe that there's been investigation that it's an uncollectible judgment with Mr. Barker's assets being held jointly by him and his wife, and that his law practice accounts really don't have much money in there anymore. So there's no funds to collect the judgment.
It might go to this court's consideration of mitigation if he had paid the money back.
That's correct.
The fact that a third party creditor can't collect the judgment, if he and his wife together had the ability to pay, would be something you think that this court could consider as it relates to mitigation.
The attempt to pay back the estate was, I think, a step in the right direction. The way that respondent went about it is not the way that you show mitigation, which is to quickly run out and borrow money from a friend so you can replenish your trust account. That's not how we want lawyers to approach a restitution.
So he wasn't trying to run away from the judgment. He actually borrowed money to even though he was judgment-proof, he still borrowed money to try to pay off.
Well, the judgment came later in time. He actually owed $81,000, borrowed $38,000. That resulted in a $43,000 judgment. That $43,000 judgment, there has not been a single payment on that. It's accrued thousands and thousands of dollars in prejudgment interest.
Was there a demand made for the money that he owed? Did the parties, the estate, make a demand for the $43,000?
Yes, they did. I mean, there was obviously a demand in the petition and then a judgment, and the attorney for the estate has monitored Mr. Barker's practice since the judgment was entered in June of 2010, came to the conclusion that it's not collectible.
Are there any more questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.